What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. John, we've done a lot of talking about border security, immigration related topics. And honestly, we need to, because it's in the news. It's not something that's in just the daily scrum. This is something that America has got to grapple with. And you know, and I know, that nobody's done a damn thing in about 30 years to really address this. One party likes to exploit for their own benefit. The other party likes to expel. So they're both really, here without some stain on their record as to how long they have allowed all of this to persist. Some might have said in the past, the Democrats want new voters and the Republicans want cheap labor. I mean, so they're all getting something out of this. But now that it seems to be boiling over as an issue, what are they really willing to do to correct the situation?
Well, we got to fix our immigration system. We got to demand our Congress fixes our immigration. We can't have people, I don't believe, flooding over the border. You know, I think we need a legitimate immigration system that works somehow, and we need to have that conversation.
And let's be honest about it. America has been built on immigrants. We're all immigrants. I'm an immigrant because my grandparents were immigrants. I mean, this is the way it works. So let's dispel this notion that we don't need people to come in and refresh the American experiment. That's ridiculous. It really is, because this stagnant pool, if we don't allow anybody in, will not flourish. Look at some of the greatest innovations today in Silicon Valley. Look at the people who are doing it. They're people who came over here and they started companies. They went to our higher education institutions. They didn't go back to China or Asia or, I mean, Europe or wherever. They stayed here and they're doing it here.
No, there's some brilliant people. I just think what's sad is going around is the slave labor that's coming over the border. These are hardworking people. These are not. And, you know, they pick them up at one of the stores and they go strip a roof and they get a couple of bucks for it. I mean, I think it's really a sad situation we've started here.
No, absolutely. And look, I don't know what Donald Trump thinks he's doing about a legacy, but I like this saying that I heard from a historian. America puts up statues to those who open doors, not construct walls. So there are better, more sophisticated ways of securing the border, but neither party is willing to make some of the political trade-offs that I think are required to do the right thing comprehensively and strategically for our nation's future. Now, there is a conservative, though a more mainstream conservative think tank that you and I turn to an awful lot, and we really like them, the American Enterprise Institute. And Pia Orenius is one of their scholars, and she and other scholars there have been looking at the fact that the U.S., and they said it very boldly, the U.S. needs workers, not a wall. Now, when you hear that, you say, okay, I think what they mean is we need all these high-skilled people to come in here. But, John, the surprise in this podcast is going to be that she said, no, we need actually people on the lower end of the capability scale or the skill scale. We still have a lot of jobs here that Americans can't pick up. So whether it is the visas to go and pick crops, whether it's to clean homes, whether it's to manicure lawns, whether it's to put up those roofs. But we've got to get a sane approach to this.
Absolutely.
Rather than saying once somebody's here and really is a part of the American fabric in communities, they've got to go back.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. It's crazy. But you know what? I blame Congress. I don't even blame Trump, because Congress is the lawmakers of the land, and they refuse to do anything because they just want to line their pockets, I believe, and be rich and not get voted out.
Well, the thing is that here's where I really think Donald Trump has made this a lot worse. First of all, he's made ethnicity part of a conversation that it shouldn't be. These are really industrious. And in many cases, when we're talking about asylum, which is somewhat of a different issue, these are people who are in deep trouble in their own communities, in their own countries. But beyond that, he also had a deal on the table. The Democrats were offering, I think it was $22 billion toward security, but it really wasn't wall involved. And he pushed that away, even though he said that he was in favor of that with DACA and all of this. And we just are at a worse place, perhaps, in terms of the dialogue and the conversation than we were before he came in. And he keeps talking about this issue as a way to divide Americans. And it's not the right way to approach this.
Well, I disagree with you in a worst way. I think it's good it's out of the bag. We've been dealing this with at least since Ronald Reagan, I think. So, but then we shove it under the carpet and it never goes away. So I think it's good it's out there. The trouble
is,
how do we
get leadership to bring it home?
Well, that's the problem.
And that's the problem. Well, listen, why do we need more workers and not a wall? Let's talk about it today with Pia Arrhenius here on America Trends. With us on the line is Pia Arrhenius, and she's with the American Enterprise Institute. And she and Madeline Zavadny have written a very interesting piece called The U.S. Needs Workers, Not a Wall. And Pia, a lot of people might consider that to be blasphemous. We've heard so much from leadership in America about the necessity of a wall. So how can you say with such a certainty, because we've heard just the opposite, that a wall is really not the answer?
Well, the argument we make, and of course we were writing this as the government was shut down partly over funding for a wall. The argument that we make is that if you look at the statistics and the nature of current illegal immigration, if you will, and what's going on along the southwest border, you see that the problems there are not the ones that would be best addressed by a physical barrier, but rather by a number of different, policies. And so it's two things. You know, one thing is, yes, we do need the workers. That's a different issue. The other thing is that the wall is not the adequate answer to the problems on the border currently.
So we have a crisis whose time has perhaps gone, and yet we are still being sold the notion that that alone is going to be the key element and the key response that we can make to a crisis at our border, which, as you acknowledge in your paper, is something of a crisis in terms of asylum and immigration, but it's not about the unauthorized, illegal folks trying to get in. In fact, in many ways, your perspective, the economic perspectives from the American Enterprise Institute, suggests that that's not what we should be most concerned about, because that has been declining over the years.
Yes, it's fascinating. If you look at the statistics, we actually have seen we haven't seen these low levels of illegal immigration really since the early 1970s. And we can also look, for example, at the population of unauthorized immigrants in the United States, and you can see that's also been declining. So the rhetoric is out of line with the statistics. What we have seen rising on the border is, as you mentioned, asylum seekers. So there's an unprecedented number of asylum seekers from Central America. And the other interesting change is that they're overwhelmingly families and unaccompanied children. So that's the change. But this is not the illegal immigration, you know, that I began studying, you know, in the 1990s, when it really was, you know, sort of a crisis. If you think of the numbers of people that were coming across, hundreds and hundreds of thousands were crossing successfully every year. And coming into the U.S. and so that it's a very, very different situation today on the border.
You remind us in this report, and you have a very bold sub headline: border enforcement is working. And that should be something that we hear more often than we do. You said the U.S. has increased border security massively over the past three decades. And you talk about a lot of the techniques and modalities that we're now using, including enforcement of border patrol agents, motion sensors, drones. So why is it that we're still being sold what is essentially a bill of goods that we don't have an adequate response to what you saw back in the 90s?
This is actually one of the hardest arguments to make, even to academics. But in economics, at least, we've been able to show in the research that there is a statistically significant effect of enforcement on both the increasing the probability of catching people who try to cross and evade detection, and also on deterrence. So now the research shows, I believe, without a doubt, that border enforcement is effective in addressing both deterrence and actually increasing the probability of catching people, as I said. Now, there's still a lot of skeptics up there, but if you look, for example, when I first started studying this issue, the cost of a coyote was maybe $300, $500. So a coyote is a smuggler that typically would bring somebody over the border into the United States. And so it was averaging the late 1980s, early 1990s, $300 to $500 per person. And now it's running $5,000 per person. And I would say this is largely because of the success of border enforcement. The research that has studied the probability of capture, the probability of catching, has shown that it's gone from being about one-third to being about two-thirds. So now you have about, you know, the majority on any given crossing, you know, the chances of you getting caught are more than 50%. So really a lot of the research is showing, I think, conclusively that border enforcement is working. And, of course, we've ramped up also punishments. And there's research showing that the punishment that you get, for example, Operation Streamline, where they actually prosecute people in federal court for crossing the border, what they've shown is that that also has a deterrent effect. And so really what the Border Patrol has been doing has been quite costly, but it's been quite effective.
Of course, this isn't a message that we're hearing today, but how hard is it to measure some of these things? So if there's somebody listening who's skeptical because they've heard the president talking almost ceaselessly about this problem and talking about drugs coming across the border, talking about the fact that there is a lot of human trafficking, and he's really painted a very dark picture for us. You're painting a much brighter picture. How do you look at that picture as a mosaic? I mean, how can we be certain that he's not right and some of these statistics are a bit misleading?
So I haven't looked recently at the statistics on how much of drugs we're capturing and human trafficking and so forth. But really the book, and of course there's definitely drugs coming through, but I think what the research on drugs shows is that they mostly come through the ports of entry. And they're not sort of walking the drugs across the desert, you know, away from ports of entry. So generally, drugs are coming through ports of entry, which, again, would suggest that a wall would not address that problem. Human trafficking, that's a tricky subject. A lot of people, so the regular type of smuggling that we see, which is sort of run-of-the-mill smuggling, just bringing people across, that's sometimes referred to as human trafficking, but actually human trafficking is very different. And human trafficking is pretty rare. So again, you don't want to sort of confuse the two. In general, most of the activity along the border, is sort of the standard unauthorized immigration where people are either coming in with a visa and intending to overstay and violate the terms of the visa, or they're, you know, coming through the desert and trying to evade detection. And that's sort of the typical, and that really is the lion's share of activity on the border, with both drugs and human trafficking being the exceptional cases. And then, of course, now we're seeing the rise in humanitarian migration and asylum seekers and so forth. And so that's also far more common.
Well, I do want to get to you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Go on.
No, I just wanted to follow up also because related to what your question is, the question whether immigration, particularly undocumented immigration or illegal immigration, is related to to crimes and the incidence of crimes in the United States.
Yes.
And so that's, you know, we can also talk about that because that's also a tenuous link.
Well, again, that's something that we're being told with regularity, and it's going to be a big part of the conversation in 2020 because the president seems to think that as a political issue, it really does get people's attention. So I'd like people to have attention on an issue if it's real. If it's not real, then I'd like them to think about other things like comprehensive immigration reform so that we can have the workers we need going forward. And we're going to talk to you about why that is so important in a moment. But I just want to make certain that if somebody is of the mind that they're hearing about all these horrible things that are going on at the border, why they should be a little bit jaded and jaundiced about how that information is derived.
Well, and so on that note, I would just like to point out, because another argument for a border wall has been to prevent immigrants from coming in and committing crimes. Now, so we did a review of the research that's been done on the link between immigration and crime, and you would be surprised to find that the great majority of research finds that immigrants are less likely to commit crime than U.S. citizens, U.S. natives, if you will. And legal immigrants are the least likely, followed by undocumented immigrants, and then U.S. natives are more likely than both those groups to commit crime, both property crime and violent crime. Now, of course, not immigration crimes. So obviously immigrants are the only ones who really can commit immigration crimes. So, you know, things that are related to overstaying a visa, for example. But when it comes to the crime that usually we mean when we talk about crime in terms of things that adversely affect others, like property crime and violent crime, the research is really convincing and shows that immigrants are less likely to commit crime than natives.
Now, you say to us in your report that Southwest border apprehensions have not just dropped, they have plummeted. But you go on to say earlier in your economic perspective on this that the number of apprehensions along the border has traditionally been one of the best proxies for attempted illegal crossings and successful illegal entries. Explain that to us just so we understand what that means, because we're looking for a measure. Because if we're looking to deflect that which we're hearing from leadership in America, and somebody comes to us and says, well, you're wrong. The president tells us this. What do you mean by the number of apprehensions being a good proxy for what's really going on?
It's a little tricky because, and you're right to point out the trouble with measuring this, because obviously apprehensions, the number of people we catch on the border that are trying to cross illegally, is a function of both the number of people that attempt to cross the border illegally and the probability of stopping the ones that are trying, you know, to actually successfully come across the border. And so it's a function of both the number of people trying and the probability of capture. And so, but what we found with that, with the apprehensions, is really just the gross inflow, if you will, of and the measure of apprehensions really tracks very well attempts. And so it's a good measure for us to be able to see what's happening with the inflow. You notice that when, for example, you line up apprehensions with the changes in the population of undocumented immigrants. So we have many different ways of trying to measure the population of undocumented immigrants. And what we found is that with the huge decline in apprehensions, especially among Mexican immigrants, we find that also the population of undocumented immigrants from Mexico in the United States has also been declining. So what does that mean? That means that this inflow is not large enough to offset the outflow, because we've also had significant outflows of immigrants from Mexico back into Mexico, and so that the net migration from Mexico now has been for several years close to zero, and some are saying even negative.
Okay, so are we talking about legal and illegal entry in combination? That we have seen many fewer coming in over the years, and in fact that the inflows, as you say, are down and the outflows are up on the main and in a net sense. That's what's really been happening since when? About 2007, or when do we date this back to?
Yes, it started with the recession. With the Great Recession, obviously, and the housing crisis, and so many immigrants, especially from Mexico, are construction workers. They're involved in the construction industry. The housing bust began in 2006 and then ran, you know, for several years. That really put a dent in sort of the jobs magnet, if you will. The other thing that we did at that time was we really ramped up in what we call interior enforcement, which ultimately, you know, can result in removals or deportations from the interior of undocumented immigrants. And so that's the other piece of the puzzle. And what we saw is that really for the first time that we've had statistics for this, we actually saw that for several years there, the outflow, including the removals or deportations, if you will, was greater than the measures of inflows of undocumented immigrants.
Okay, so I want people to understand this. First of all, you're saying that there was an impact from the crisis that we had, the financial crisis here in the United States. We've also had a lot stricter enforcement, more border measures, the ones that I mentioned earlier about drones and a whole range of things that we put a lot of money into administration after administration, when there are many of us who have been critical of the whole process of immigration and how both parties have handled it. So that has been going on, perhaps in not a comprehensive way in terms of looking at immigration, but at least some of these measures. Then you tell us that in addition to those things, that we have also had tougher interior enforcement, as you said. And I'd like you to describe what that looks like, because the president keeps calling out these immigration courts and judges for extreme ridicule, saying they're the worst in the world. People end up going all hither and yon, and we never know where they are, and we can never find them again, and they're just lost in the soup in America. Can you help us understand that?
Sure. So first, in terms of the enforcement measures that have been implemented really in the last 10 years in the interior of the country, it really is, like you pointed out, a mishmash of both state initiatives and federal initiatives. And so some of the federal initiatives, for example, are the secure communities, for example. Some of the state initiatives are the E-Verify provisions. So E-Verify, you know, in some states, it's mandatory that employers check the authorization of their employees or their new hires, make sure that they're authorized to truly work in the United States, and they allow them to verify this electronically. And apparently, in the past, people have used a lot of fraudulent documents to be able to qualify to work in the United States, whereas now if you can, as an employer, check those documents against the government database in real time and electronically, then obviously you can prevent, the hiring of undocumented immigrants. And so in some states, this is mandatory for all employers. So that's what we call the E-Verify provisions. And so those are important piece of the puzzle as well. The other part is secure communities, and we actually saw between secure communities and some other measures that were implemented really in the last 10 years, we saw that deportations and removals from the interior of the United States went up to well over 300,000 people a year, which was really a record amount.
And much of that during the Obama administration, correct?
Exactly, exactly. That was the irony, was that this ratcheting up of deportations actually happened, yes, that's right, under the Obama administration.
And why don't we have 100% usage of E-Verify? I mean, that would seem to be such a simple thing to do. You remind us that it is substantial now. Over 50% of the new hires have to be authorized to get a job. But why isn't that 100%?
Well, so in most states, it's still voluntary whether employers want to participate in the E-Verify or not. And, of course, it is a little bit costly for employers to have to sort of assign somebody to run the records through the government database and so forth. So probably if employers think, oh, I don't think I have a problem, or perhaps they say, I don't have any immigrants working for me, and I certainly don't have any illegal immigrants working for me, then they may decide, you know, not to go through the trouble of running, you know, the E-Verify checks. And so, you know, the majority of employers still do not use it. Nevertheless, a lot of the large corporations do, and so that, you're right, we've found that over 50% of new hires in the United States are now currently being run through E-Verify. And this, in other research that we've done, is actually a large deterrent, you know, for the employment of unauthorized immigrants. So it's a program that is fairly cheap compared to border enforcement. It's cheap compared to interior enforcement. It's actually a very cost-effective alternative to other types of enforcement, and it's a deterrent for illegal immigration because obviously it's affecting the jobs magnet. It takes that away. It takes some of the pull away. And so we've argued that in terms of all the, you know, a menu of enforcement mechanisms, this mandatory verify on a national level would make sense.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is going to be coming down the road in a comprehensive package at one point. Pia Arrhenius is with us from the American Enterprise Institute. And I think it's really important for people to understand that there are also factors going on in Mexico, and then I want to get to other parts of Central America, and then I want to talk about why we need new workers, not a wall. But you tell us that the drop in unauthorized immigration is also due in part to demographic and economic changes in Mexico. I mean, Mexico's doing pretty well right now, but they've had a drop in birth rates. So there are fewer younger adults with less reason to leave. They also, while they have high violence and limited economic opportunities, you tell us, in certain parts of the country, other parts are doing quite well. And I don't know whether the new trade deal that we are undertaking with them will have any further impact. I think NAFTA did have some impact on people coming over to the United States. So on the main and in the aggregate, what are the factors in Mexico that have mitigated the flow of people who are undocumented?
Well, there's, as you point out, there's several factors. So again, I'd like to go back to sort of when I first started looking at this issue, writing my dissertation at UCLA, I was looking at what was happening in the 1980s. What did Mexico look like in the 1980s? Well, you know, it was a basket case. It was hyperinflation, you know, debt defaults, a number of problems in the macroeconomy, and actually very rapid inflation that was actually really hurting the purchasing power of the Mexican worker. And so deep problems in Mexico at the time. And in fact, again, even in the early 1990s, they had another crisis where their currency depreciated radically, and obviously the interest rates were ratcheted up, and so anyone who had debt was was wiped out. So it was a difficult time for Mexico. And at the time, also with the unstable macro, the demographics in Mexico were very different from what they are today. Women were having, on average, families with 6 to 8 children, and today they average between 2 to 3 children, just like in the United States. With families, 6 to 8 children, very large families, very unstable macroeconomy, limited opportunities, hyperinflation, you know, moving to the United States or migrating for work was a natural result of that situation in Mexico. It's nothing like that today. Their inflation rates are running 3 to 4%. They have a stable macroeconomy. It's not booming by any means, but it's growing 2 to 3% a year. Employment is growing. Formal sector employment is growing. Wages are inching up. You know, they're not booming, but real wages are growing in Mexico. It's 1 to 2% per year, but real wages are growing in Mexico, and there's a lot more opportunity and stability than there used to be. And this is what's keeping people home.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now explain to us, and then we'll get to the worker situation in America that really speaks to the need for changes in our policies. But tell me why it is that we are seeing this backlog on our border today of asylum seekers from Honduras and Nicaragua, and what is the Mexican role as a conduit in terms of geography to these people ending up on our border? Explain that to us.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so this is sort of a relatively new problem for us. It's developed over the last few years, and I think it's related, you know, to the situation in Central America, which has been bad and hasn't gotten markedly worse in any given year, but it's just been maybe progressively slowly getting worse, I guess. But so there's little economic opportunity and lots of violence, and there's a huge presence of gangs in Central America, and a lack of the rule of law. So, you know, people are very susceptible to crime and gang activity in these countries. At the same time, these Central American countries also have huge migrant networks in the United States. Going back to the 1970s and 1980s, when there were civil wars in many of these countries, you know, a lot of the Central Americans came here as refugees or asylum seekers then as well as a result of those civil wars. So the migrant networks exist. Conditions are bad in these countries, and so there sort of is a natural reason and a natural manner in which, you know, these people can come here. Contributing to sort of the natural push and pull factors, if you will, is asylum laws and the problems with some of the processing and the backlogs in immigration courts. So I think actually the administration now is taking a closer look at exactly what these pull factors are and what are the incentives under the current asylum system that is bringing more and more people here. But one hint, for example, is why are the majority of these asylum seekers from Central America unaccompanied minors, for example, mm-hmm. and women and children? So the reason for that is directly, you know, it correlates directly back to the laws that govern asylum seeking. So there is a law that protects unaccompanied minors. If you've been abandoned by a parent, you can claim, there is a rule for you that would allow you to stay in the United States. And so people are rationally taking advantage of these opportunities. And then, of course, there's another, the way we've been for the last few years also treating women that are subject to domestic violence, you know, they've also been able to claim asylum for that. And so the you know, whereas we obviously have a very important role in protecting people from other countries that are fleeing for their lives, but at the same time, we can't ignore that the laws and policies that we put in place are creating incentives, maybe broader incentives than we originally intended, for more people to come.
Well, you also point out in your report that the Obama administration expanded the grounds for granting asylum based on domestic violence and gang violence. So we understand that. But we're all, I think, in America today, very confused between immigration and asylum. And I think those two are being put together in a blend and used for political purposes. But they're very different issues.
They are absolutely different issues, and they have different solutions. And so asylum obviously is how to treat asylum seekers and how to do it in an efficient, fast way is very tricky. We saw a recent, in Europe, they had an unprecedented spike in asylum seekers in 2015, and they got well over a million in just a few short months, and they were completely overwhelmed. And, I mean, what did they do? I mean, they cried. From what I understand, I'm not an expert in European asylum seekers, but from what I understand is that they're trying to, push the ones that they catch. They're actually sending to Turkey in some cases, sending them to third countries to try to wait their time out there, process their applications from a third country. The reason they do this is to try to remove the incentive to simply apply for asylum, even though you're really an economic migrant and not a humanitarian migrant, and so you're unlikely to get asylum. But while you're waiting for your asylum case to be adjudicated, you can work and sort of integrate into the new country. And so what, you know, countries are doing is like what they're doing in Europe, for example, trying to remove the incentive, trying to preserve the integrity of the system for the true asylum seekers, and trying to sift out the economic migrants that are, you know, coming for economic reasons, but posing as asylum seekers.
Okay, very quickly, because then I want to get on to the workforce needs in America. Why is it then, very quickly, that Mexico is not absorbing, if they have a better and a growing economy and fewer of their own children being born, why are they not able to take in some of these asylum seekers before they get to our border?
So I think a lot of that has to do with, well, obviously, conditions, pay and work opportunities are still better here than they are in Mexico. But Also, the migrant networks, as I mentioned earlier, family members and so forth are already here for a lot of the Central Americans that are coming. They have family here. They don't have family in Mexico because there hasn't been a tradition of really Central American settlement in Mexico. Now, that said, I do want to say that Mexico has a really important role to play in these caravans and other streams of asylum seekers from Central America. And they've been doing a really important job stopping thousands, tens of thousands of asylum seekers and deporting them or allowing them to stay or taking them back to Central America. And so I think the data I've seen any given year is 50 to 60,000 that they actually either catch and detain or catch and remove. And so they're trying. It's also a difficult problem for them. But I think the solution clearly lies in collaboration with Mexico and to figure out, just sort of like the Europeans have done with Turkey, to figure out how can we collaborate in a sensible way to create the incentives where the true asylum seekers get through and the economic migrants do not.
Okay. Now, your report is called The U.S. Needs Workers, Not a Wall, and some people might disagree with that premise. Why do we need workers when there are Americans who are on the shelf or have been over the period? Many of them are coming back into the labor force. You say that we are unlikely by various programs that we have now, the H-2A, the H-2B, to fully meet employer demand for less skilled workers. We don't hear this very often. We hear we need people with all these incredible skills from all over the world for technology. Why do we need less skilled workers when some think we're going to be able to automate many of these jobs and responsibilities?
Oh, yeah, this is another interesting obviously intersection with the migration policy is labor policy, or what kind of workforce do we need and what is the status of the labor market currently. So what we've seen with this unprecedented decline in illegal immigration is actually an unprecedented tightness of the labor market for low-skilled workers. So we've seen that, because to be honest, where did we get most of our low-skilled labor for the last 30 years? Honestly, we got them from Mexico, and honestly, they were mostly undocumented. In fact, today, in the United States, over 50% of workers who lack a high school diploma are foreign-born. That is the category that has the largest, the skill category with the largest share of immigrants. And so when you cut off the supply, which we've done, because I've argued that because of improvement in Mexico and because of border enforcement and other policy changes that we've made, we've actually cut off the supply, and the supply has dried up, of these undocumented workers that used to fill the low-skilled positions. So for the first time, really, since I've looked at this issue, for the first time, we've seen employers complain more about the lack of low-skilled workers than the lack of high-skilled workers.
Wow.
I mean, they had 20 years ago, they could not complain enough, even 10 years ago, about the lack of high-skilled workers, and they wanted STEM workers, and they wanted, healthcare workers. You know, they want doctors and computer programmers. And now what do they want? They want construction workers. They want plumbers. They want truck drivers. They just, we run these surveys, and we ask employers, hundreds of employers, and we ask them every month, where do you have the hardest time finding qualified workers? And they'll either tell you low-skilled or mid-skilled workers is where they just can't find enough, and they can't retain them.
Okay, so here we are. We've got this issue. And you're telling us that we're not going to, because of our fertility rates, we're not going to generate enough of these workers. We have lots of areas, home care, agriculture, a whole range of things. What are the policy prescriptions that might help and yield better results if we actually need these less skilled workers?
Yeah, so, I mean, I work in immigration policy, so I typically look towards, immigration policy can be an answer to bringing in, to legally bringing in some blue-collar workers. Of course, there's other things we can also do just in general in the United States for U.S. natives, for our own children, in terms of, not necessarily telling kids that you have to go to college, you have to have a bachelor's degree, perhaps making other types of of degrees and certifications and other types of technical education more accessible and more acceptable, doing a better job funding those types of degrees that maybe are more mid-skill degrees or diplomas and not necessarily bachelor's degrees. And so there's a lot we can do on both ends. I mean, the market should naturally sort this out as wages rise for the more blue-collar and mid-skill workers, which we are currently seeing. So there should be some of that. But certainly institutionally, we shouldn't arrange our community colleges and all our four-year colleges and our high school programs to be designed just to encourage kids, you know, tell kids that they have to have bachelor's degrees. Because I think that's been part of the issue, is that we're also not just declining fertility in the United States, but also the fact that educational attainment has been rising, and kids, for example, are much less likely to work today than they were sort of when you and I were young. Students had jobs, and today most students do not have jobs. They dedicate themselves entirely to school, and so that's another change.
So will continued economic growth in America really require that we raise the caps on immigration, simplify the rules, have more of a comprehensive approach to immigration? I mean, is that going to be demanded of us in the coming 3 to 5 years?
Absolutely. If you look at the demographics, you see that because of the retirement of the baby boomers, all of the growth over the next 20 years in the labor force is coming from either immigrants or the children of immigrants. And so, I mean, it's shocking to see the numbers, but the demographics, those are pretty good predictions and forecasts. And so the correlation between growth in the labor force and growth in immigration is really a one for one for the next 20 years until we get through the retirement of the baby boomers. And so how do you address this? Well, you address it with, well, what we think is a reasonable approach is to expand temporary worker programs where we allow people to come in from other countries and work temporarily in the United States, on a legal basis, sponsored by employers in a way in which is, flexible and also important that, for example, these workers can move between employers because, we've seen that sometimes when workers are stuck with just one employer, there's some, an imbalance in the power structure. There can be some worker abuse and so forth. So we've argued for sort of bringing in foreign workers under these employment-based programs where they can actually sort of move around the U.S. labor market and address, the sectors, the industries where the needs for workers are the most severe. And, I mean, it's stunning to think, if you look at the labor markets today in the United States, we have the lowest unemployment rate we've had since 1969 today.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Pia, I know that you have got to get on to some other work that you're doing, but I want to thank you because I think if people really delve into this report that you and Madeline Zavodny have done for the American Enterprise Institute, they'll have a much better understanding of what it is that's going on at the border and the implications for our labor force going forward. The U.S. needs workers, not a wall. And Pia Arrhenius, if they want to get this report, how can they do that?
Well, I think it's readily available for free on the AEI website.
All right, AEI.org. Thank you so much for being with us today. And we really brought you through it in a very detailed way. But I think people need to understand because there is a lot of misinformation that they're getting today. And I think you have helped to clarify it on America Trends today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, Larry.
Yeah, what's up,
Chad? I've got some exciting news for you.
Well, let's hear it.
We're part of the MHNR Network.
And where can we find that?
That's MHNRnetwork.com.
I'm going there right now.
All right.